Views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Treaty that comes to you every Friday evening between 9 and 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And here on Race Treaty, what we do is to bring some of our esteemed community members, activists, who are taking into their life the work of past generations in terms of affirming their human rights. And tonight, we have with us Ty Christian Joseph, who has been coming into those ranks. I met him at Columbia University, where I teach, and the course was social welfare policy, which I don't teach that. I teach social unwelfare policy because we are not well. So why would we have words that would describe a reality in which we're not experiencing? That is quite, I would say it's really a massive type of deception. That deception is coming through the words in which we use and how we use them. Of course, we're giving reference to the United Independent Compensatory Code System concept, a compensatory counter-racist code that was developed by Neely Fuller Jr. And we would certainly recommend that everyone in the audience acquire that book. We'll try to make the information available for such an acquisition. Because words give us our structure, it gives us our life, it gives us our meaning. In philosophy, that's called ontology. So words are very important. And, you know, this young man here, Ty Joseph, uses words very effectively. In fact, I was his student in the class. He doesn't know that, so he's probably smiling right now. But, yes, I learned so much from him, and he's eloquent. He's thoughtful, he's dedicated, and he's on the line with us right now. Brother Ty, blessings and welcome.
Brother Onaje, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for that humbling introduction, my brother. It's greatly appreciated.
So I want to say that you are truly the best of us because your heart is clearly one that's filled with compassion and filled with love, and that your actions, you know, is representative of that. You're not one to sit back and let others assume a responsibility. You are, in fact, assuming yours in so many ways. So if you would be so kind to share with us, our listening audience, where were you born? Where were you raised? How did you get to Columbia? Why are you at Columbia? And the work that you've done, have been doing, and continue to do at Columbia. So please, since that's one of your stomping grounds, and you have others as well, but please share a little bit about yourself to our listening audience.
I'll try to be as succinct as possible. I was born in Brooklyn, Flatbush, Brooklyn, to be exact. I went to Canarsie High School. It was a very militaristic experience being there. Even before that, I was, you know, my mother is kind of a hippie, kind of a, she's mixed race, she's Cuban, she's Jamaican, she's Chinese, she's Portuguese, she's Jewish, and she's a very liberal mixed person who in her mind encompasses the world. And I was really raised with that kind of mentality. I went to an African-centered, preschool called Sparks of African Genius. Being there, that the ideas of being Black and being happy and enjoying your Blackness were really inculcated into me from then, and it's still there now. That school probably had the largest influence of all of my education. So when I got to Canarsie High School in Brooklyn and I was forced to go through metal detectors and every day and be searched up and down and have police walking up and down the hallways. I mean, they considered themselves security guards. They were called security guards. They didn't have guns on them, but they looked exactly like police, right? So, and there were police cars outside of my schooling and things like that. And I, you know, with this hippie background, I still, these things seem very strange to me. So when I started listening to hip-hop music, you know, Talib Kweli, Mos Def, Nas, people of that ilk, Erykah Badu, you know, they really spoke to me in high school. And it's basically, I would say that I was in the movement partially, at least in my soul, before then. But ever since high school, I really started being able to speak up, and people knew me for kind of being an agitator in whatever system I was in. I graduated high school a semester early, and I interned with the Harlem Veterans Association for about 3 years. But it started with the first 6 months that I had free between high school and going to college. When I got to Long Island University, I was able to study sociology and anthropology as well as social work. And I traveled to Costa Rica. I gained a scholarship where I traveled to Costa Rica and I studied with indigenous people, and I was able to see them in their society and gain the idea of land and people being able to exist within their own culture and what that means. And I was also taught a lot about corporations and basically how corporations come into Native people's land, maybe under the guise of patriotism, maybe under the guise of their nation, but it's typically corporations coming in wanting to take resources out of the country and basically enslave those people. And I learned about that in what's known as the Banana Republic in Costa Rica. That's one of the stomping grounds for that kind of work. So after that, I came back to Brooklyn, OIU again, and I was empowered. I started fighting against police brutality, organizing protests against the murder of Sean Bell and people of that like in the early 2000s. And I was elected to student body president of my university, OIU Brooklyn again. After that, I graduated and I had a deep loathing of America, and I felt that things were never going to change. I was hated for the protests that I organized. I mean, I was loved, but I was also hated. I felt that my life was in danger in a lot of ways. So I decided to leave America. I went to Korea. That's a long story also, but I won't give you that one. I went to Korea, then I went to Japan, I went to the Philippines. And then I went back to Korea, and I eventually made it to Ethiopia, where I stayed for 5 years. So in all, I was out of America for about 8 years, and I stayed in Ethiopia for five of them. In Ethiopia, I helped co-found the National Spelling Competition, the first debating society, and I used the anthropological skills that I had learned in Long Island University to, I applied a lot of that in Ethiopia, and I studied various cultures, groups of people, tribes. There are around 85 tribes of Ethiopians, and there are probably more than that that we are unaware of. And I studied around six of them, some that are very important to me. I've studied the Tigray people, I've studied the Oromo people, I've studied the Agal, which are the oldest form of Judaism known to man. I've studied the Beta Israel, I've studied the Falasha. There's various different groups that I worked on and with while I was there, besides being an educator and a anthropologist, a researcher, an explorer. I worked with the Ministry of Tourism there to create a documentary about a journey that I took across that country, which was a over 500-mile journey from Addis Ababa, which is the capital city, to Lalibela, which is an ancient Christian site, an ancient African Christian site known as the Israel of Africa. And that was recorded, and they've been working on the documentary for years now, and they're starting to promote it a lot more. And we're working on getting it into the Smithsonian here in DC, and the Ethiopian community here in DC also has shown support for it. So we're pushing it around this summer, and we're getting it into a few festivals. So that's really cool. And then I got to eventually I left Ethiopia, and I came back to America, in order to obtain my master's degree in social work, and that's where I met Brother Onaje. And for the past year, I've also been an agitator in that system, and there have been things that have really bothered me, and I didn't know that being out of America for 8 years. I wasn't sure what I was getting into. I knew that Black Lives Matter was popping off, and I felt that this was the right time for me to kind of come back, share the knowledge that I have with the same revolutionary attitude that I've always had. And that's really come out at Columbia, and it's worked to my benefit, and I think to the benefit of a lot of different marginalized groups. In Columbia University, at least the social work school. So we're in a situation where we have a number of teachers of color, which is good. And they teach well, but at the same time, we have a lot of very highly overly problematic white professors. There are some black professors who are also oppressing other groups, and we usually have a situation where the overwhelming number of students in the class are white, in a profession where the clientele, the people who they are serving, are people of color. A lot of them black, let's be honest, a lot of them black and Latino people. So if that is the situation, these white people should be people who are working to ameliorate the situation in those communities that they're serving, as opposed to being people who are career social workers and see that oppression is a way for them to make money. And sustain their living and make a life for themselves. Now, I don't think oppression is something that people should reap benefits from. I think that, yes, if you do good work, you should be compensated for your work, but the work that you do is in an effort to end the chaos in those communities. And the fact that there hasn't been any end, things have only gotten worse in these communities, says that the field, the profession of social work is failing. Social work, the School of Columbia being at the top of that profession, maybe not number one, but you know, we're top three, and there is a case to be made that the school's curriculum, the system of the school, everything that the school has done in the past to prior generations, all of that needs to be addressed, and it needs to change in order to, dare I say, fight back against what's happening in our society right now, okay? Right now, we are in the midst of a white supremacist onslaught. Every element of white supremacy that was at its worst in any time in history is going on right in front of us now. If it's lynchings, if it's people being murdered, if it's the drug war coming back to its peak right now, especially dealing with marijuana, if it's the KKK holding rallies in numbers that we haven't seen in years, if it's the homeless rates in New York City being the highest since the Great Depression. So there's a lot attacking us. And at the same time, the wealthy are making the most profits that they have ever made, okay? There's so surplus over and over and over for what they're doing. So if there's ever been a time for people to actually advocate for policies that truly change this society, because we have the money to do it, we call it the richest society in the world. It's actually the most unequal society in the world, and that we have the most rich people, and we also have the most poor people for any developed nation in the world. So there is a way to fix that. It's through taxing the rich, okay? It is through stopping their monopoly over the society. And I think that's what we're trying to instill in our students at Columbia University with this push. We're pushing for a power oppression and privilege syllabi, basis of the curriculum, with an undertone, a theme of anti-black socialist theory and radical pedagogy. So with all of those theories, we're not just saying that we want people reading about it. They will be reading about it, but that is not enough at this juncture. We want people to be actively taking steps in the classroom, around the hallways, in the community, Harlem, where Columbia University is located, to ameliorate the situation, okay? And I think that we can do that. We have the money to. The issue is that a lot of the students and a lot of our administration do not see the benefit in fighting against these systems of oppression. So that's where I'm at now, and that's what we're trying to do. Me, as well as several other students, have been given positions within the university in order to push forth these ideas. If they are giving us these positions in order to pacify us, that would be the wrong way to go about it, as we have already shown them through protests and various other things. I mean, people have threatened, professors have threatened to quit over the things that we have spoken up about. students have threatened to go to other universities and things like that. So this is something that's needed, and I don't think I'm the only one that sees that or who's speaking up about it.
That was sometimes what people would say, a mouthful. That was, whoa, a stream of consciousness that, and the listening audience is getting an example of how impressed I was with this young man in class, and now you certainly are experiencing that as well. I want to go back to this African-centered school that you gave mention of.
Mm-hmm.
What was the name of it, and how many?
Yeah, it was called Spark, and this is the thing. This also relates to my fight, man, because the fight is against racism as well as patriarchy. The name of the school is called Sparks of African Genius, and it was started by a group of women, a group of Afrocentric women, late 80s, early 90s. I got there in, like, I don't know, 89, 90, or 91. I went there from pre-K to the first grade. I have vivid memories of being there, maybe more so than any school I've ever attended. I remember I remember the prayers. We had prayers that we would say every morning that were in Swahili. Our clothing was African clothing. What's that?
Do you remember one that you can share with us?
If I can say it perfectly, it was like, Sefazu Day, all praises to the Creator, our Chakwa has been blessed, now we may eat. I believe that's what it was. I may have the first few words a little bit off, but that's what it was.
Zende Kwa, Chakula. Sante Sanas. Sekula. So this is so interesting in that you have keenly demonstrated the value of self-determination, particularly
definitely,
as it relates to education. I, too, was affiliated with an African-centered school, an African-centered school movement. It started... particularly in Brooklyn, it started in 1968 with Ocean Hill Brownsville protests, where they were given the responsibility, if you will, authority to control their own school district. I think it was through the Ford Foundation. And when this group of very conscious African brothers and sisters took over the school, they changed the curriculum. The Jewish teachers protested it, and the National Guard was called in, and those individuals, the Afro-American Teachers and Student Union, left and created Yehudu Sasa, Freedom Now. And Freedom Now School was part of a national organization called CIBI, Council of Independent Black Institutions. I was very active in both. When I was attending Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, studying industrial engineering. So to see this this legacy, this lineage, you know, this information being passed down from one generation to another is proof positive that when people take their own history as well as their destiny in their own hands, then we can continue the consciousness that has been part of our people's movement from the beginning, since we've been on these shores. So to hear that is quite reinforcing and inspirational to hear this sojourn that you've gone through. Do you recall the founders of that school?
Yeah, I do. I haven't been able to make contact with any of them. I just, you know, I know them by like Mama this and Mama that. So the woman who owned it was Mama Fayette. Mama Fayette was the owner. I can actually, I'm sure my mother knows also, I can get you the names of the other teachers as well. I might be able to make contact via other people that I know. you know, just in the community, but I haven't spoken to them in years, but they definitely are a big part of my foundation. You know, those women, it was maybe four of them.
Well, you've inspired me to have a show on African Centered Schools. I'm still in touch with many of the creators of those schools throughout the country, because CBE was a national organization. So there were, you know, schools in Detroit and Chicago. In fact, when I went to Chicago in 76 for what was called the Teacher Training Institute, it was there at the Institute of Positive Education, Hakeem Abuti, Sister Sophia, who were the founders of that school. There are many still across the country, and there's a different generation now, of course, a number of generations, but this movement has continued, and you have inspired me to give out a call to them to be on the show, and certainly we would want Mama Fiati and the others who are on the call to be on that show as well. And of course, you can't do it in one show, it will be a series, but you are calling us back to the center. You're calling us back to the middle, where we to the circle, where we can say, okay, family, what's going on these various geographical and political terrains, and how might we respond to them? So listen, so we talked a little bit about that. So now we're going to move forward to your travels. You know, you traveled extensively. And of course, Malcolm X said travel broadens one's scope, and certainly did that very much for you as well. So what are some of the high points that you actually came in consciousness of in your travels as a result of being outside of America and looking in, rather than being in America and looking out? When we are in America, well, let me not say that. I want to correct myself. When we say America, we are continuing a colonializing language oppression, because it's not the United States is not America. It's just one part of North America. So it's the United States that I'm talking about. So in the United States, it's sometimes being on the stage, you know, and the lights are on you, and then you're looking out into the world, you know, which is doesn't have as much illumination, at least in terms of the media. So when you were in the so-called dark zones, if you will, what did you see looking back? And looking back to the United States, how did that change your thinking over time?
Well, the first thing that I'll say is that, in my opinion, it's not a dark zone. I mean, if we're using dark in a way that dark means lightness, like, because being outside of America, in my opinion, was where I was able to become aware of everything going on in the world. You know, in my opinion, being in America is where I'm cut off, where I'm only able to learn about what's going on in New York City, what's going on in California, you know, maybe in a few places around this country. But being in Korea, being in Japan, being in Ethiopia, the news that you get is from everywhere. You learn about everything going on. You also learn what's going on in America consistently. I feel that I have my knowledge intake has drastically decreased since I've been back. So that's first. In terms of how did I feel like being out, and you know, what did I learn outside of there? I think that Korea is where I spent the brunt of my time, as opposed to Ethiopia. In Korea, I found that, you know, my blackness became so much more pronounced. And this was something that I realized that the world felt about me. That's why I'm so much more sensitive to it now than I ever have been. I mean, I was before. But then it was like when I got to Korea, traffic would stop. People would damn near about to get into car crashes because of my black body crossing the street in a certain area of Korea. I had a Japanese girlfriend at the time who I was with in Korea, and people thought that she was Korean, I guess. So people would make like X signs towards us. They would spit towards us. You know, it was like America in the 1960s in Korea for me. So that was a real eye-opening experience to see that a very similar brand of racism that's in America was very present in Korea. Now, I never blame the Korean people for that. I think that those are methods that have been supplanted by America through American culture, through American media, American military. Like, so I studied many different religions. I studied Buddhism. I studied the Muslim faith. I studied various forms of Christianity. I got into a bit of Hinduism. So I was able to do those things in different places. So in Korea, I studied Buddhism. When I traveled to Egypt for a short time, I studied the Muslim faith, and I also did that in Ethiopia. In Ethiopia, I studied the Orthodox Christians. I also dug a bit into the Ethiopian form of Protestant Christianity, which is very different, but it's prevalent there, so I was interested in it. I was into the Ethiopian form of Judaism as well. So, yeah. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question perfectly.
Yeah. Very much so. You are. And I'll just say, you know, two things in terms of the conversation I was flowing. When I was using dog, I was using it in relationship to the media, in terms of what the media spends its time and focuses on. And you confirmed that in America, excuse me, in the United States, everything is turned inward, and you don't really see what's happening in the world, even let alone what's happening through other states. And then you went on to say that you were using the word America, and I was saying that my invitation is for us not to say America when we're talking exclusively of or about the United States, because
yeah,
we disappear, you know, Central and South America when we just say America as a metaphor for the United States. So, yeah. So we covered, you know, your background. We've covered your travels, but I certainly want to have you speak a little bit more about Ethiopia and the film that you gave reference to.
Yeah, I mean, Ethiopia is, in my opinion, the pinnacle of my life. I feel like after that, I've been ready to do anything. I mean, I'm my life is, you know, I don't know, I feel done. But there are lots of things that I want to do, but it's not as necessary as it would have been after I made it there. So I don't know if I made a step too soon, or if it was a good thing that I went there at this point in my life, or at that point in my life. I've always been into minimalism. I've always been into cultural relativity. I've always been into Africa. I've always been into, you know, African strength, which to an African American born person, you know, if you're trying to grasp on to some African heritage, Ethiopia is kind of the foundation of fighting back, of not being colonized. Now, all, in my opinion, all Africans did fight back, and all Africans did do amazing things. Ethiopia, for whatever reason, for whatever corruption, whatever purpose it was, divine intervention possibly, that allowed them not to be colonized, is really what made me want to be there and to experience that culture So there are various facets of that society that I saw. I was able to see roots of things that I was taught about Africa, as well as just general behaviors that I see many Black people have in America that was present in people in Ethiopia. So one example of that was in this place called Wolaita Soto, which was it's a town, and I was in this kind of bar, I guess you can call it that, and there was a guy that was playing this instrument called the masinko, which is the foundation of the guitar and the violin. It looks like both of them put together. And he was playing it and singing, and I couldn't understand the language at this time, but the friend that I was with, he told me that, okay, this guy, he's making up a song about you. And my friend started translating the song to me, and the song was rhyming, okay? And the guy was making up a rhyming song with this instrument just based on looking at me. And I was, in my opinion, that was hip hop. That was like everything that I grew up with. That was people in the high school lunch tables beating on the table, making up rhymes about whatever they saw. So that was very moving. A lot of the dance movements are, I've seen in various West Indian or African American dances, whether it be the new dances that I see happening now or the older dances that I grew up with. I saw lots of similarities in Ethiopia, various hairstyles. There's a lot of similarities between Caribbean food and Ethiopian food. What is it? Peter Tosh. I learned it from a very old Rasta that Peter Tosh, and this is a true quote, that Peter Tosh said that the foundations of Rastafarian music come from the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And I saw that, and I felt that in that church. That church spoke to me, the Spirit of God spoke to me in that setting louder than any time, anywhere in my life. And I'm someone that believes I can experience God anywhere, but it was excessively pronounced. There were numerous times that I would be walking in Ethiopia, look up in the sky, and feel forced to bow down and break into tears. And I don't know why those things have happened to me. I did this journey. When I was going on this journey with a horse for 45 days, over 500 miles, I almost lost my life on three separate occasions, and not due to any people trying to harm me. It was always a case of something natural happening, some challenge that I was being presented with, and people ultimately coming to my rescue. It was the people of the country helping me over and over and over. Even though my language wasn't perfect, I was supported by the people. One, because of the way that I looked, but at the same time, because they knew that I wasn't from this country, there would be times that people would try to solicit money from me. And if I had, I would give. But at the same time, I was trying to build connections with people as opposed to have them see me as some kind of rich foreigner there to give them money, which I wasn't. I had been working in the country for a year at that time as a teacher. I had very little money. And I was on that journey to raise money for an orphanage in the country. What little money I had was meant for horse food and like my food, and in case any of us get sick, which both of us, you know, we did have problems growing. But it was maybe the most life changing experience I've ever had was that journey. It was a spiritual journey. I feel that it was. I feel that I was watched over by the spirits, by my creator, by my ancestors, and by my family and friends. And yeah, I started this national spelling competition there, and that was in partnership with Ethiopians. And I am not there, and that is still going on its own, and that influences a few thousand students around the country every year, and they get the winners get prizes. It encourages people to read. It encourages people to read their language, whether that be Amharic or the Miso or any other of the myriad languages there, or if it's reading English, which I promote as using English as a weapon in order to defend yourself against forms of westernization, which is the dominant culture in the world. It's not that you should learn English. English is more important than your language. No, that's not correct. English is needed because you're under attack, and you need to be able to understand what your attackers are saying in order to defend yourself effectively. So that's where I'm coming from with the whole English thing. And with the debate, there are several schools that participate in that. It's not very large. It just started a year ago. The Spelling Bee, by comparison, is 5 years old. And, yeah, the debate is going very well. They hold them at, they hold the debates at embassies around the city. And, yeah, that was good. I worked at four different schools when I was there, so I was able to make various different connections. Yeah, so, yeah.
So those who are just listening in, this is Onaji Muid on Race Treaty. And we're speaking to this young man who's had at least three lifetimes, maybe four, of experiences, given his different travels and places of residence and exploration, discovery, and unfolding. So we're going to take a station break here at this moment, and we'll continue in another moment. So, yes, you're at the right place. Talk to you in 1 second. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. Welcome back to Race Treaty. This is Onaji Muid, your host, And we're speaking to this young man, Ty Christian Joseph, who's been, had a tremendous life. A person who I had the great pleasure of meeting when he was when he graced my class at Columbia University teaching social welfare policy, and he's given us in his first 45 minutes, you know, autobiographical sketch of his life and the different places he's been, the lessons he's learned, and who he has become, and the things which he's doing now. So I want to bring us up to when you got back. When did you get back to the United States of America?
August of last year. I got here on August 20th.
Mm-hmm. August 20th. Okay. And that's after being out of the country, out of the United States for what, 8 years?
Yeah, I was out for 8 years. I left in 2009. Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. And came back in 2016?
Yeah. So, like, I left at the beginning of 2009, came back at the end of 2016.
Wow. So, certainly, we'd want you to write about that because it's so important Again, let me go back to the quote that said that Malcolm X said that travel, expands one's mind, right?
Man.
And this is the month of May, and we in the last few shows have had various guests, and we've asked them to reflect on what extent did the Malcolm X's teachings, his writings, his voice, whatever, influence you in your life.
I mean, Malcolm X is foundational, right? So growing up in America, the initial reference that I have when I was two is Martin Luther King. I was screaming his speeches outside of my window since I was about 3 years old. As soon as I grew into consciousness, there's Malcolm X. Okay? So Malcolm X is still a huge part of me. I mean, I had CDs of his speeches that I would listen to consistently. A part of the way that I speak is based on Malcolm X. The fact that I embrace the dictionary and studying the dictionary, it's a part of my daily routine to learn new vocabulary words. That comes from Malcolm X. Now, I was able to implement that more in Ethiopia. It's hard to do those things here, but in Ethiopia, it was very normal for me to do that. But that idea comes from Malcolm X. I mean, the Black Panthers are another big part of my personality. They are rooted in the teachings of Malcolm X, you know? So he's such a foundation. Everything that he stood for, his transformation from what he was as a young man to when he became Mr. X to after he traveled and came back. I believe all of that is very important. And also the way he died, the fact that he COINTELPRO worked to have him assassinated. All of that factors into my life and the decisions that I make. One of the reasons that I left the country and was not going to come back. All of that applies to my trajectory.
Wonderful. Okay. All right. So, you're back to the United States of America, and you decided to go to social work school because you said your undergrad is a bachelor's in sociology.
Well, I have a BSW. It's a bachelor's of social work, but I have a minor in anthropology and business management. Yeah.
So, okay, so what high school did you go to?
Canarsie High School.
Okay. And what's the demographics in terms of student population, in terms of the teaching staff, Black, white, Puerto Rican,
So when I
Dominican, or what?
went there, I'm not sure if it's the same now. I've heard that the school has changed. It's one of those schools in New York City that they've had to break up into other schools, like four separate divisions, because it's so bad. But when I was there, the population was about 99% Black and Latino. So segregation is real. You know, I start learning these things the past few years that segregation is so real in the northern states because of policies and laws that weren't implemented here, that were implemented in the South. So segregation is real. It was about 99% Black and Latino, mainly Black. The teachers were mainly white. There were a few Black teachers sparsely around the school, but mainly white teachers.
And what did you learn? What was your
Kindergarten
social
school was
consciousness
Black.
at the time?
What?
What was your social consciousness at that time?
It was still fairly high, you know. I never joined a gang. I was a football player. You know, I got into fights. There were times that I had to fight to defend myself, not necessarily in school, but around. And so I graduated scholar athlete, you know. Like I said, Jay-Z was good, but Nas was better. I was more on the conscious side of hip-hop. Nas was the better rapper. Talib Kweli and Mos Def were the greatest rappers on the planet because they were speaking truth to everything that I had been through. They were giving me history. They were speaking about love. They weren't forcing me to be a gangster. So through hip-hop at that time sort of protected me and allowed me to sustain the consciousness that I had from places like Sparks of African Genius and from my upbringing with my mother and stuff like that. So it wasn't extremely high, but it was higher than most people around me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the things which you're doing now. So was it in high school that you thought? When did you decide to go into social work, or anthropology, or sociology? Were those ideas birthed while you were in high school?
No, not in high school. I would say that in terms of anthropology, I took a sociology class. And I really took to sociology. It came to me very naturally. I felt that it was just a part of me. It spoke to everything that I was. I'm not sure why, but and I think that has to do with poverty and looking at society.
And what year did you graduate high school?
2004.
Mm-hmm. 2004.
Yeah, okay. 2004, I believe. Yeah, 2004. I graduated early, so I was done in that December, so I might have been done in 2013. And so I at that time, 2014, January, in between then and me starting college, I interned full time with the Harlem Veterans Association, which was in Building 55 on 125th. While I was there, my uncle was he was the case manager there.
And what's his name? What's his name?
What's that?
What's his name?
Walter Bridgers. He recently retired. I think it was January he retired. He's a master social worker also. Vet, Vietnam vet, Korea vet. No, Korea, not Vietnam. Just Korea. So
wow.
It was mainly through speaking to him and interning under him that I decided to go into social work. And he, you know, he told me about how broad it was and things like that. But at the same time, okay, this is important also. I took a career test in my sophomore or at the end of my freshman year in college. And on the career test, it said that I would be a priest, a rabbi, a preacher, or a Buddha. And the guidance counselor said that she had never saw a response like that from the career test. And so I'm not religious. So I think social work was the next best thing to something in that realm. So I think that's what really drove me to social work.
Okay, so so after high school, 2004, right?
Yep.
Okay, and what year did you leave the country?
I left in 2009.
Okay. And came back in 2016. Got it. Okay, now I'm getting my numbers, getting my chronology straight. And so it would be a natural progression to get your bachelor's in social work and then pursue your master's in social work. And you started Columbia last September.
Yes.
Okay. And you spoke a little bit about the experiences. So what are the activities? You mentioned this oppression course that you oppress something in an oppression course. What is that?
Yeah, so this comes from the this demands group that was started before I came to the university. A group of students who got together and put this list of demands together that things that need to change at the university in order for it to be in line with the values of social work. One of them was to have a class on power, oppression, and privilege. And at this time, we have an elective for that. Students can voluntarily take some sort of class around that, but there's not an emphasis in the curriculum to focus on the anti-Black stigma rooted in, and I'm saying this accurately, America, rooted in Western culture, which prevents many of the social justice initiatives from fully taking, take doing what they're supposed to do. So with this class, what we're trying to do is force, not necessarily force, but we're trying to
Hold them accountable.
enlighten. We're trying to enlighten the administration, the staff, the student body through many of the more conscious students and through the curriculum committee at the university, to let them know about the different levels of oppression at play within the society that they encompass, and to let them know the different levels of vulnerability that people have that determine their safety, and to go really in depth into what it means to fight for social justice, to be a social change agent.
I'm gonna try something here. Let me see if this works. I happen to have a recording of the meeting when the students met with the administration, and they were in fact insisting that the school must meet their demands. Let me see if I can pull that up. Give me one second.
Okay.
This is about the profession's history on the foundation of social work's unique context and perspective. Service, social justice, dignity, and worth of the person, the importance of human relationships, integrity, and competence. Meeting our demands. Social workers assistance with cultural and ethnic diversity and strive to
I
end
can't hear you.
discrimination, oppression, poverty, and other forms of social injustice.
Meeting our demands.
Value, social justice, ethical principles. Social workers challenge social injustice. Social workers pursue social change, particularly with and on behalf of vulnerable and oppressed individuals and groups of people. Social workers' social change efforts are focused primarily on issues of poverty, unemployment, discrimination, and other forms of social injustice. These activities seek to promote sensitivity to and knowledge about oppression and cultural and ethnic diversity. Social workers strive to ensure access to needed information, services, and resources, equality of opportunity, and meaningful participation in decision-making for all people. Meeting our demands.
Ty, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, so I have that recording on my computer, and I was playing it, and I heard it while I was playing it. It came back to myself. It is questionable if it was actually recorded to this device in terms of the program. We'll know that once the program airs if it was there or not. And I would make that splice available to the producer who could hopefully splice that in. So this course is it was born out of the students' activism. The students, including yourself, taking the courage, you're the second iteration of that. This group having the courage to confront the administration and make it happen. And certainly, just recently, I did see an email from the interim dean that the course will go forward as planned. And I would imagine there were some hesitations at some point, but through the activism of you and other students, the administration relented. And really, the only thing they're doing is doing what they should have been doing all along. So it
Right.
isn't something that is, this is not an extracurricular activity. This is the very core of what social work talks about,
Exactly.
doesn't act on, but just talks about, the very same way that the Constitution talks about freedom, justice, and equality and rights. It talks about it, but in actuality, the way people are treated, certainly they are dehumanized, oppressed, and marginalized.
Right.
So what hopes do you have for this course? What do you think that it would actually do with respect to the administration and the students? And I did hear you say that some of the teachers threatened to leave. That's, well, when you have constipation, it need you know things need to be excavated. Things need to be left, like gone, like removed. So it's quite interesting that you that this. This demand is having that effect, and I don't know if these professors actually left or not, or still contemplating of leaving. But it's good
Well,
to hear.
if the course doesn't get pushed through, they that was what they said, like if the course doesn't get pushed through, then we're leaving.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant the other way around. I thought you meant that the professors was protesting its
No,
appearance.
no, no,
And
no.
they would leave if it was taught. Okay.
No, 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 no. The problematic the professors who were doing the who are pushing forth these erroneous ideas, it's difficult for them to find a job in a progressive, prestigious organization. Now, this school claims to be progressive, but a lot of the professors are not in line with that. But a majority of the professors are, and a lot of the top-ranking professors are, the more contemporary, known professors are in line with the code of ethics, like they're not trying to sustain oppression. But I think when it comes to this, the dean, so basically the dean initially said that this interim dean that we have, Irwin, he says that, that's his name, right? I'm not sure. His name is Irwin, right?
Garfinkel.
I just see white men. I just see white men at the top of things, right? That's it. I don't really put names on them. It's just like another white man in charge of some nonsense, right? So he said that the class could not happen at this time, that it wasn't feasible for it to take place in the fall semester. Even though the university agreed years ago, before I got here, that they were going to implement the class. So they decided that they weren't going to do that all of a sudden, which is the basic stagnation, the constipation, as you describe it, that we have seen again and again and again. Okay, this kind of serpent behavior of, you know, it's just because we don't have the time to do this. And that can go, that can be put to any social justice initiative in the United States of America. We just don't have the time. We just don't have the money. There's always an issue why you cannot alleviate this oppression that you're benefiting from. So when he sent out that email, I was highly upset. I know that there were other people who were upset. And this class that I was taking, this experimental curriculum design and social justice class, in power, oppression, and privilege, in that class, we had designed the syllabi already. And we put a lot of labor into it. And there's a lot of trauma that went into that in terms of dealing with it was a mixed class of white people and people of all different cultures and stuff like that. It took a lot, and it was a growing experience. It was beautiful. And that's what we wanted to translate to this university. And so when he sent that email, you know, there was me and one other student who were particularly enraged. A lot of the class felt defeated, but we were enraged. And we decided that we were going to do something about it. We decided that we were going to send a message to the university, and not necessarily by protesting in the typical fashion, but we wanted to overwhelm the university, okay? And we understood that a five-minute protest wasn't going to do that, or even an hour protest wasn't necessarily going to do that. But we were going. I thought about things that we could do that would make a lot of different people uncomfortable, a lot of students, a lot of staff members uncomfortable in places that they consider a comfort zone. So we devised these posters, these flyers that looked like event flyers, but were actually messages to oppressors, to people who didn't want to acknowledge the Native American land that this school was built on, to people who were very comfortable pushing forth oppressive notions and oppressive statements in classes, people who were in this university to get a Ivy League degree and go out and become profiteers of the plunder of my community. And these were the kind of messages that we were sending out. Okay, so we put this around the entire school. We wrote it on blackboards. We wrote it on whiteboards. We put it in elevators. We put it on entrances to doors. We put it on staff doors. In addition to that, during the lunch period for about 30 minutes, students stood in one line with the posters quietly and silently, but directly within the lobby and the entrance. So people had to walk around them. Okay, people could not walk in and out. And this is a high traffic time of the school. People could not walk in and out without engaging with them in some way. Okay, so whether that be having a conversation or just feeling uncomfortable with what's going on in front of you. So with that happening, professors also decided to, we started a petition. In addition to that, we got around 240 people to sign that petition, current students, alumni, incoming students, all signed. I believe some staff members also. Staff members threatened to quit. There were some students who threatened to drop out if this class is not implemented, if this curriculum is not changed. With that uproar, the the dean changed within a day. He changed that decision and decided to get money in order to implement this class, and offered the people who were in the class positions in order to train the teachers, in order to TA the classes during the semester, and in order to synchronize the school's advocacy class, the foundation class, and the direct to practice class, to synchronize them with what we believe the prop class should be. So the idea is to take the core elements of each of those three classes and supplant elements of power, oppression, privilege, radical pedagogy, and anti-Black theories into the curriculum. Now, if there's a situation that we can't do that, then we're going to end up fighting again. That's what I see happening. But hopefully we will be able to bring the two courses together in a way that everybody's happy.
So those who are listening in, you're listening to Onaji Muid, co-host with our guest, Ty Joseph. And I have a surprise to the listening audience. Not only have we been privileged to hear of his life and what he's doing right now, but we will be further privileged in that he will become a co-host of Race Treaty, where he will be having his own program slot according to his convenience. And you can see that's going to be a journey in itself, trying to coordinate time when he can do this. So we'd like to extend an invitation formally to you to become a co-host and ask you what might be your plans, because we want young people's voice on this radio program. And it's not just news. These are activists. Everyone who is a co-host is actually doing work in the community. So this is an activist program that has many people from around the country. Right now, we're focusing on, for the next number of years, on the decade for people of African descent, 2015 to 2024, with the theme themes of just of recognition, justice, and development, social, societal development. And we'll have guests to speak more specifically to that, to this movement that's happening worldwide. But that's the overarching theme in which everything is pretty much connected to that. And certainly that's connected to the question of reparations, which is has at least four components: restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, which, of course, social work, for it to be to have its weight and goal, must attend to that particular aspect of rehabilitation. And the fourth aspect is monitoring, a monitoring system. We have one that was created in Asheville, North Carolina, with Dr. Dwight Mullins, and we'll have him on the air as well. So there are a number of things, structural things in place, but know that this is about organizing, agitating, organizing, and moving our people forward. So we are so happy that we have Brother Ty on the phone for that. So in your last comments, Brother Ty, please let us know what might be your initial thinking when you're going to co-host.
I think that I hope that it's something that's entertaining, something that's enlightening, something that is. I think humor is important, you know. So I think humor and musical elements would be nice. As well as activism, you know, that's the biggest part of my personality. So that's going to be evident, and just connecting with as much with the Harlem community as possible, and getting some good voices from marginalized communities to be a part of the dialogue, and covering interesting, unknown or uncovered topics within the American frame. There are a lot of things that internationally that we can benefit from that just aren't covered in our media that I would like to talk about. So I hope to bring some interesting perspectives, yeah?
So I want to thank you again, Brother Ty, for taking time out of your most busy schedule to be on the air with us, and look forward to you co-hosting. This is Onaji Muwaid for Race Treaty signing off. Thank you so much.
Thank you.